Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Good morning, Frank Luxa. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Frank, you have just accomplished a pretty remarkable goal, I think. Would you like to share with the listeners a little bit about what you did, and then we'll talk about how you got started in dogs?
Okay. Well, we just recently finished a dual champion English Setter. She's the 13th in the breed history, and it's been quite a while since the last one has been obtained, so we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah, it's been since 97, so you're talking a good solid 30 years here.
Yeah, 97, I believe, was the last dual champion that also had an amateur field champion, and then I believe that the year 2001 might have been the last dual champion.
Dual champion, okay.
Yes.
Wow.
So, there's two titles there.
That is, in the sporting dogs, this is a very worthy goal, particularly, I think, in English Setters, where you see a pretty significant divide between your field trial dogs and your show dogs. And it goes all the way back, in my understanding, and I actually owned English Setters, the Llewellyn Setter that was developed as a field trial dog and the Laverick Setter that was developed as a show dog. And these were two prominent breeders in the late 1800s that developed
exactly,
these lines
yes.
of dogs. And so give our listeners that aren't aware kind of a distinction. You know, what do you see? What are the primary differences in style between these two types of the breed?
Yeah, I mean, aesthetics are the first thing you're going to notice when you look at them. I mean, one's a much smaller dog, more racier dog. The other is, you know, more substantial looking, with more bone and a hell of a lot more coat, generally, you know,
right.
in order to compete in the show ring. So.
Right.
But aside from the looks, I mean, just the performance is a little different in the field as well. One dog is much quicker and snappier, and the other is more of a methodical, but in a way, foot-hunting type of dog. Yeah.
Right. And there's style differences, too. Your Llewellyn Setter is a real high-tailed dog, and your Laverick Setter tends to be a lot leveler tail.
Yeah, and if you're true to the standard for the breed in the United States, the AKC standard, the standard says a level tail off the back.
Right.
Even on point, you know, generally they're going to have a level tail, where the Llewellyns is, you know, they're looking for a 12 o'clock tail straight up in the air, like many of the setter breeds are like that, you know, today. So that's one of the pitfalls.
Yeah, that's the common thing that the field trial judges want to see, that 12 o'clock tail. They want to see that snappy running style. They want to see that sharp pointing style. And it can be a real challenge when you're working with a dog that has not been bred specifically to have that tail set and that tail carriage.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. And so I assume you're working with a dog that when we would consider a Laverick, or is this a Laverick Llewellyn cross, which I actually had one when I was a kid, or how did you develop this dog that was able to do both of these things?
No, I mean, she is purely a strictly Laverick. I mean, her bloodlines go back, you know, everyone's a show champion, her bloodline. I actually owned the mother, so we bred her to somewhat of a line breeding to the lines that I had. And her mother was a master hunter. She had a fairly decent run. I have some field trial placements with her, but like we talked about before, she just wasn't as quick as needed to really win in those all breed trials. So.
Right. And you're running all breed horseback trials, not walking trials.
We did both, but it was funny. I seemed to have better luck in most of the horseback trials once she, you know, matured, and she got it. She just loved the sport. You know, you just see it, you know, when she's at the line. So, and when she sees me get on a horse, she definitely knows the distinction. Okay, I can really give it my all now.
Exactly. And I believe that dogs absolutely know which game we're playing based on whether we're on foot, whether we're on horseback, all of that.
Oh, I agree. And that's where a good dog is going to make that distinction, you know.
Okay, so you got started in dogs as a kid, yeah?
Oh, I did. Growing up, my first dog was he looked like an Irish. He was a big red dog, but he was actually, my understanding is it was a mistake between a guy that had two show dogs. One was English, one was Irish, and a mistake in breeding. And my father was not going to pay for a dog in them days, so he jumped on Snoopy, and Snoopy, he was a class act. Everybody, you know, I just was a very young kid who worked just walking along, but all my relatives, they would come over, and my father wasn't home, they would take Snoopy out, so but that was my beginning, yeah.
I love it. And you've owned short hairs as well as Snoopy, and then what was it that sent you off to English Setters?
My last short hair was the great hunting dog. At the time, that's basically my interest. Then, you know, I got married and we had our first child, and I was looking for a more of a family type of dog. And I'd start doing some research, and the English setter seemed to fit the bill. I had phoned a Brittany breeder and an English breeder, and I just happened to go to the English first, and I think that's probably how it happened. You know? The problem I made is I brought my wife and my daughter along, so you know, any puppy, we're going to come home with a puppy that day.
Oh,
no matter
yeah.
what.
that's a slam dunk, man.
yeah.
And so your girl, Tessa, that's now the dual champion amateur field champion, she is descended from that first puppy that you bought?
No, actually the second. That was kind of the middle ground in the English today. He's considered the Ryman type, which was, that was kind of the cross, and you probably have heard about that, the cross between the show and the field going back 70, 80 years, I guess. Yeah, so he was from one of those breedings, and then I'd never been to a dog show before, and I seen one at my local park, and we went over there and walked around, and we found the English setter ring, and I started talking to folks, and then I first see my first really true show type of setter, and I just fell in love with the looks, and so that was from there we started research, and then we ended up with Tessa's mother, Duchess, which is, you know, it's a pure showbred dog.
Okay. And the English setter breed has done relatively well in comparison to some of the other sporting breeds that are so drastically divided by type. There have been a couple other famous dual champions. Does this go back on Haji, Melissa Newman's dog, or is this completely separate?
He's definitely in there. Yeah, actually, because of my line breeding, he's definitely there about four generations back, I guess. But if you search English setter pedigree, it's going to be hard to find a pedigree without him in it.
That is true.
Such a dominant sire in that time.
Dominant influence, for sure,
yes,
in his era.
Yes, yep.
Absolutely. Okay, and so special challenges that you ran into, it's been a long time since anybody's done this, I think because field trials are getting tougher, dog shows are getting tougher, the competition is more fierce. What were some of the challenges that you ran into that you could give people that might want to try and accomplish the same goal some suggestions?
I did the opposite, I think, of what most people try to do, and I did I said, I'm going to go for the field titles, work on those first. So I started really from the whelping box on, you know, just from, you know, recalling the puppies over with cheese and making noises. So I would say, you know, start out young, try to get the puppy points, because it really could help you in
yeah.
the long run, you know,
yeah.
the puppy in the derby. I mean, that's something I could tell you. But also just, I run into so many people in the breed that are afraid to take them dogs out and let them off lead and let them run. You know, they're just, you know, if you have a safe place to do it, of course. But,
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main thing. I mean, the challenge with the bench dogs is they haven't been strictly bred to run the edges all day long, like most of the dogs you're competing against. So, you know, that was one of the things I just worked on. I mean, she tended to kind of be smart and sometimes get on the other side of a hedgerow and hunt back with the wind in her face. And sometimes judges, they're not going to want to, I don't blame them, they're not going to want to turn around the saddle. They want to keep looking forward. So that dog's got to keep running ahead of you. So that was probably one of the biggest things we had to work on as far as developing her at a young age.
Well, and I think that's true of any trial dog, getting them to run the lines, getting them to stay to the front. If you can keep that dog between 10 and 2, you're going to make a lot better impression no matter what your breed.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you have to get, it's just like in the show ring, it's a performance. You've got to put on a show and catch their attention, you know, from the start, you know.
Right. And I think one of the other things that I was super impressed as I was reading your story, you owner handled her in both the show ring and the field.
Yeah, that put it tough on her as far as that goes, because I'm not a professional.
Well, I know, but I think the point is, as an encouragement to other amateur owner handlers in the field and in the show ring, that it can be done.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Did you have any particular mentors or people who helped you along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I had mentors on both sides. I mean, what really impressed me is how the community came together from the show side and the field, that, you know, once they knew what I was trying to accomplish, they were, you know, always there cheering me on, and, you know, and just whenever I needed a comb or whatever it might have been, you know, they were there to help because they wanted to see this happen, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I did have a few, like the woman that helped me whelp the litter, Judy Graff. She's been in the breed forever. You know, she was a great mentor in the show side. And my co-breeder, Mary Coldiron, you know, she was always there to help out.
Excellent.
Yeah. The field side, I just kept at it. I mean, they got sick of seeing me, so they're going to start putting me up, I think.
No, I'm here to tell you it doesn't work that way. And in the process, you got your trial judge's license also, yeah?
Yeah, I started that back with my first dog. I kind of did the gradual, you know, I just had him as a hunting dog, then I joined a local club, and then I got into the AKC hunt test. And they did those for years, and then, you know, let me try this trial stuff. And somebody said, hey, you should trial that dog, you know. And I actually didn't end up trialing my first dog, but the second dog I got, I said, no, I'm going to try this, you know. And, you know, I just gradually never thought, you know, I would ever like doing a horseback field trial. I was a hunter, you know, you did everything on foot. And I didn't have nothing. I loved horses. And once I got on and put the two together, I was like, I don't want to walk again.
Ever. totally with you on that. You like get me up on a walking horse. Nope, never putting my feet back on the ground.
especially in the muddy springtime or whatever it might be.
There's rocks down there. I want to ride.
Exactly.
Awesome. And so have you enjoyed the judging aspect of it in terms of what you're able to learn, and how did that apply to your ability to improve your handling and your training to finish your dog?
Oh, exactly what you're saying. I mean, the more I judged, the more I was more critical on my self-handling and my dog. You really got to ride every brace and see every dog before you can judge. Like, why did that dog get put up today? If you didn't see them all, you don't have a clue. You know, it's just, it amazed me too. When you see dogs that are just consistently been bred for the field trials, that they're making improvements every generation, where I'm in a little bit of a hardship when you just breed dogs to look good. You know, no one's setting out to say, I'm going to breed the field ability out of a dog. But if you're not improving it every generation, you're going to lose some of it, you know, or just not improve on everybody else's competitive dogs. So, yeah, I mean, just judging is, you gain so much more knowledge as far as what it takes to win and just, you know, make improvements in your own line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And going forward, what are your plans going forward with Tessa? Are you going to breed her? Or are you going to continue to make, or do you have another one? You want to make another one? What is the future?
Yeah. I mean, I do have her sister, but you know, like I said, it's so tough having both in one dog that I think I'm going to concentrate maybe on looking for which is the other hard part, finding a stud that would complement her on both ends. So that's really our goal for the future. But she's only 3 years old, so three and a half. I'm not done, you know. I still want to have fun in the field trials with her, but, you know.
I thought it was very interesting when you were talking a little bit earlier about doing the field piece first, because I show a lot of dogs for people that are working towards their duals in my breed. And the common wisdom is we do the show piece first, because then they haven't been roaded, they haven't blown out their shoulders, they you know, all of that aspect. And so I think it's very interesting that the field piece done first, you were able to keep her in good enough shape. Is that because you didn't rode her with chains? I mean, how did you keep her in condition?
I always just free ran her. I have never roded her, you know, harness yet. I think I may start. I really want to, you know, hopefully if we can get some national championships going, I want to, you know, really build her up for that. But yeah, that is always the thing. Well, as soon as the day after I finished her field champion, I said, okay, that's it. I'm not taking any more chances. Something stupid could happen in the field and she could be, you know, lame or whatever, you know, it's an injury. So then it was like, all right, what do I do to grow her coat? Because that's the other stumbling block. You know, when you field trial, even probably your breed, it's going to lose some of that coat.
Oh, it loses a lot of that coat.
Yeah. And that's what it's really where it should be. You know, if you read your standard, you know,
exactly. It's not supposed to be fluffy.
You know, no, that's me dragging the ground, you know.
Yep, exactly. And so how long did it take you to grow a show coat on her? Because I assume you had her cut down for the trialing.
No, I never really cut her. I just would comb her out every, you know, after every run and try to keep her as clean as I could. But I did show in between. She actually won a winner's pitch in a specialty, you know, with very little coat. Luckily, it was a breeder judge, and she looked at the dog, not just the hair. So I was very, you know, pleased with that. So probably took another 4 or 5 months to get enough back that we're, you know, she didn't stand out when she was in the lineup, you know.
Right. My thinking is it would have taken you 6 months. So that's good. Good job.
Yeah. Probably about that. Yeah.
Right. Excellent. All right. Well, Frank, thank you so very much. Just so you know what I'm working on with this, I'm going to interview Melissa as well, because I want to compare and contrast how hard it was today versus when she did it with Haji, because I think that's a fascinating study to look at. You know, the trials are competitive now. What does it take for a major out there for you guys?
Field trial major.
Yeah, field trial major.
What's it, 13?
Yeah.
I believe for, yeah.
Right. And then what is a show major for English setters in your area?
It just went up again. It was 6 or more. Yep, and it just went up. Yeah, and that's the thing. I'm kind of, you know, I'm out here on the East Coast. It seems like we have some of the best show dogs out there hitting up our shows.
Yeah, you've got some beautiful setters out there.
Yeah. And the trial circuit, you know, I always look at that running list before I, you know, head out. And it's like, wow, you get to know that very quickly, the top dogs and, you know, the short hairs and the wire hairs and the pointers. So, yeah, it can be tough. But, I just searched, you know, the East Coast and then went as far as Michigan and Ohio and just had some good luck along the way, thankfully.
Well, we all know that sometimes that's what it is.
Yeah, the weather plays a big role, you know.
Yep, excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much, Frank. I really appreciate your time, and good
luck.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
Okay, you too.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.